the day every year when the President makes his State of the Union message is a date. Now, Theodore Roosevelt's speech, obviously, he's speaking from a position of tremendous authority and tremendous power. This is the period when the United States of America is becoming, by a long way, the most powerful country in the world. And we're in a period when the people are beginning to think that the decline of Britain is likely as a major imperialist. At this time, I think they have a quarter of the world, the British. So that's the situation of the United States and the situation of the President. If he's speaking from a very influential position, in that way, perhaps we might compare him with Carnegie, who also is very powerful but has economic power, and very much contrast with some of the other documents like Tom Paine, when he's a grassroots activist hoping for change, or John Locke, who's a philosopher. So they're all very influential people. Of course, that's why the documents are in this brochure. But this is the first one we have from a major international political leader. In this section, he's going to talk about how the government should deal with, or continue to deal with, the question of Native Americans, or as people said at the time, Indians. He speaks of the Indian reservations, and this is to remind us that as the United States expanded westward, different tribes lost their land, which was taken over for agricultural purposes, or sometimes for cattle raising. Many of the Indians died in the wars which were involved, but far more died through the diseases which Europeans brought over, sometimes deliberately, but often more or less accidentally. So we're talking about a Native American population far smaller than it was 200 years earlier. Now, what does he say about Indians? He speaks of them in the way which we recognize today as racist. He says that they are not men. In the last line, he says they're not men. They may become men. For the moment, they are savages. And the progress towards civilization. They are not the only people in the world who are spoken of in this way. The English spoke of the Irish in this way for the longest time. And of course, racist representations of Africans are tremendously popular in this period. But it's very interesting to see what he considers are the main factors which will allow the United States government to make the Native Americans into Americans like the others, which is the declared aim. First of all, he says it's good news that they're beginning to be interested in work. Now, of course, Native Americans have always worked, because otherwise you don't eat if you don't work, whether it's gathering or hunting or whatever you do. Naturally enough, Theodore Roosevelt would like them to accept capitalist work. He wants them to say, yes, I want a wage every Friday. In Britain, it was every Thursday. Really, I don't know why. It was every Thursday. I want to work for a wage. And he says in the first section, we have a few more. We have more Native Americans working for a wage now. And one of the ways we did it is we reduced the resources we gave them. And we can see here then quite a number of Indians, I'm using the terms of the time, lived on government food and government money in the reservations. Now, this was, of course, a big culture shock for the Native Americans, because they lost their land, but they gained. Well, they're given enough to eat. There's also enormous problems with alcohol, because the culture shock of losing their land, at the same time, the alcohol merchants arrived and sold alcohol, and there was an absolutely massive, I mean, I'm talking of people dying of alcohol. I'm not talking of people having a couple of pints on a Saturday night. Well, the
Native Americans actually don't have alcohol. They don't have
I had no idea. Thank you. Okay. So alcohol is more dangerous.
Yes.
Even more dangerous. It has to be said, in 1900, alcohol was dangerous in Britain too. I mean, you would find people dead in the streets. I mean, you know, alcohol can still be dangerous, but you know. Okay, thank you. So, what else does he say? So, this question of how to make people who had another culture accept capitalist work is very interesting. It's a very interesting problem, and it doesn't come up here for the first time in Europe. And I'm thinking of Britain because that's I know what they had tremendous difficulties getting village peasants, small farmers, to become capitalist workers. This idea, we start every Monday at the same time, was extremely difficult for people to take up. And quite often they used to, in Britain, in the factories in the 19th century, they used to celebrate Saint Monday. That is to say, we don't work on Mondays because, you know, we don't feel like it. It's because we're calling it Saint Monday. They also used to have this wonderful, this is not directly related to America, but they have this wonderful tradition after the weekend, not after the weekend, when they first got a 1 week's holiday. What they used to do is they'd come back, all of the workers would come back to the factory on the Monday, and they would have the brick ceremony. One of the strong men would take a brick and throw it up into the air, and if it came down, they didn't work that day. Yeah. Of course, naturally it came down. So this very, very interesting ritual. Of course, the ritual really is humiliating the boss, because of course it will come down. But notice that people didn't stay in bed. They all came to work to watch to see if the brick's going to come down or not. So this is a wonderful popular culture thing. That's not really directly related to Roosevelt. Okay. In the second paragraph, so in the first paragraph, he's looking at this question of how to make Native Americans want to work. And one of the ways is to not give them enough food. And I imagine there were many other ways too. I'm afraid I haven't done much research on Native Americans at the time. Now, in the second paragraph, the second and third paragraphs, he says. That one of the problems, he accepts the criticism that many people have made, which says that the Indian Bureau, that is to say the Department of Government whose job it is to organize the Indian reservations, that's what it is, yeah, okay, that they're no good, that they're corrupt, that they're dishonest. And first of all, we should notice here that he accepts this. He says, oh, well, they're not completely corrupt these days. Well, they're not completely dishonest these days. He suggests that in the past they were really completely corrupt and dishonest. Yeah. Notice that. Make sure you don't make a mistake here. It's a, no, je sors de mon commentaire. Je vous dis. Attention, an Indian agent n'est pas un Indien. Hein. C'est un agent gouvernemental qui s'occupe des Indiens. Hein. An Indian agent is l'employé du gouvernement de l'administration responsable pour les Indiens. On ne parle d'aucun. Comment dire? Le gouvernement, il n'embauche pas pour l'administration des Native Americans. Okay. So he and he suggests that they need. Better management. Says, for the moment, we have a lot of Indian agents who are the boss of the Indian Bureau in some reservation, but they're not well paid, they're not well educated, and they don't care. And he says, we need better management. But it's interesting what he says. He said, what do we need? We need Indian agents who are good business managers. So he considers that the main problem is getting Indians to become workers. Because what kind of people do you need? He says, oh, he doesn't say, oh, we need people who can speak Indian languages. No, that's not a problem for him. He doesn't say, oh, we need good communicators. No, he says we need business managers. That's what we need, hard business managers who would normally be able to run a decent-sized business. And then finally, in the last section, he speaks about reorganising the Indian Bureau, and in particular having a close contact between the Indian agents, the government employees in the field, that is out in each Indian reservation, and the people in Washington. Now, close contact is not easy. What does he mean? How would you have close contact with somebody in Washington if you're in an Indian reservation in Arizona? What kind of close contact could you have? Close personal contact. Well, this would have to be write a letter every Friday. They don't have. There are telephones, but not in the Indian reservation. Not a lot of telephones. Yeah, so this is really about writing letters. And so what they're saying is, let's have a new system. You're responsible for Arizona. Do you want to? Arizona is okay. Yeah. Okay. And so I want you to write to me every Friday about what's happening in the week, and I will write back to you every Monday. Now, it will take 2 weeks for the post to arrive, but you know, we'll do what we can. Oh, maybe not. Now, 19. No, maybe 2 days. Now things have been moving. So this is his idea. So what now? Notice that this is part of the president's annual message. It's a long message, but he takes 4 or 5 paragraphs to talk about the Indian Bureau. So that shows that it is an important issue. It's not a little detail. Because otherwise, I mean, the little detail, he's not going to be talking about them, yeah? For this document, the presidential address, I think that's very important. Whatever piece you get of Roosevelt things, you have to think, you know, why is the president talking about this? It must be quite important, you know? It's not some local councillor or the mayor of a town talking about these questions. This is the president. So he is saying, you know, I have 1 hour and 40 minutes. I have 1 hour and 40 minutes to talk about America, and I'm going to talk for 4 minutes or 5 minutes about the Indians. So you know, it has a certain importance. Okay, that was my improvisation of what I would do with this. Notice then, quite a lot of time. I recommend that you spend quite a lot of time on context. So, who is Roosevelt? But not just who he is. You know, he was born in 1858 and he had asthma when he was a child. Okay, not so important. But more, he was looking at what kind of government was suitable for the powerful United States of the 20th century. And he was very interested. He was very good at it. In his job, he was good at doing it. So here we have this intermediate stage. If you go 100 years back, in 1800, you've still got parts of the West, which are still the Wild West, yeah, the frontiers. Huh? You've still got national organization is pretty shaky. Corruption is general. You know, you buy yourself a place in the Senate. Roosevelt is about accelerating modernization. Because also, one of the things about imperialism is that if you want to be the most powerful country in the world, you can't do it when everybody is working for themselves, when everybody is dishonest and corrupt. It doesn't work. Okay, any particular questions about that section or anything you didn't understand? That's fairly clear. I'm going to look at another section in a minute. But just as a break, of course, it's been a while since we saw a rap battle. So here we have a rap battle between Theodore Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. Now, I should just point out that Winston Churchill became famous, or is famous, for his role in the Second World War. But he was very old. He was already active in the First World War, and in particular, he was very much criticised for his military organisation. But in any case, just as two great leaders of two great nations, they are going to have a rap battle. Which one is the best one? So let's see what they come up with.
Doing the
Oh, passez les annonces, oui, allez, d'accord. Je sais pas qui c'est. Hein. Ok, epic rap battles of history. Theodore Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. There you go. That's probably something you should, I think it's something that in L3 classes we should actually do. We don't make them, but you know, but perhaps that's a little bit too avant-garde for the UFR de lettres de sciences humaines. Okay. Just one anecdote. There's a lot of things they mentioned there which are based on truth, of course. And there's just one anecdote that I didn't mention, that somebody tried to kill him, and he got a bullet in his chest, but he didn't cancel his speech. He went to give the speech with the bullet in his chest. It was in the muscles of his chest. It didn't get through. Well, otherwise he would have just died. You know? But yeah, it's got a certain style.
It's 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Of speech.
Yeah. Even I wouldn't do that. It is
impressive.
Yeah. This speech is 1 hour and 40. Because I don't like reading long speeches, so I transform it into MP3, and then I listen to it when I'm doing my supermarket shopping. There you go. Now you know everything. The second section I wanted to look at is, which I'm not going to comment in the same way, but I'm going to look through. Caesar says, it is not true. Okay. It is not true that the United States feels any land hunger or entertains any projects as regards the other nations of the Western Hemisphere, save such as are for their welfare. All that this country desires is to see the neighbouring countries stable, orderly, and prosperous. Any country whose people conduct themselves well can count upon our hearty friendship. If a nation shows that it knows how to act with reasonable efficiency and decency in social and political matters, if it keeps order and pays its obligations, it need fear no interference from the United States. Chronic wrongdoing or an impotence which results in a generally loosening of the ties of civilized society may, in America as elsewhere, ultimately require intervention by some civilized nation. And in the Western Hemisphere, the adherence of the United States to the Monroe Doctrine may force the United States, however reluctantly, in flagrant cases of such wrongdoing or impotence, to the exercise of an international police power. If every country washed by the Caribbean Sea would show the progress in stable and just civilization which, with the aid of the Platt Amendment, Cuba has shown since our troops left the island, and which so many of the republics in both Americas are constantly and brilliantly showing, all question of interference by this nation with their affairs would be at an end. Our interests and those of our southern neighbours are in reality identical. They have great natural riches, and if within their borders the reign of law and justice obtains, prosperity is sure to come to them. While they thus obey the primary laws of civilized society, they may rest assured that they will be treated by us in a spirit of cordial and helpful sympathy. We would interfere with them only in the last resort, and then only if it became evident that their inability or unwillingness to do justice at home and abroad had violated the rights of the United States, or had invited foreign aggression to the detriment of the entire body of American nations. It is a mere truism to say that every nation, whether in America or anywhere else, which desires to maintain its freedom, its independence, must ultimately realize that the right of such independence cannot be separated from the responsibility of making good use of it. In asserting the Monroe Doctrine, in taking such steps as we have taken in regard to Cuba, Venezuela, and Panama, in endeavouring to circumscribe the theatre of war in the Far East and to secure the open door in China, we have acted in our own interest as well as in the interest of humanity at large. There are, however, cases in which, while our own interests are not greatly involved, strong appeal is made to our sympathies. Ordinarily, it is very much wiser and more useful for us to concern ourselves with striving for our own moral and material betterment here at home than to concern ourselves with trying to better the condition of things in other nations. We have plenty of sins of our own to war against, and under ordinary circumstances, we could do more for the general uplifting of humanity by striving with heart and soul to put a stop to civic corruption, to brutal lawlessness and violent race prejudices here at home, than by passing resolutions about wrongdoing elsewhere. Nevertheless, there are occasional crimes committed on so vast a scale and of such peculiar horror as to make us doubt whether it is not our manifest duty to endeavour at least to show our disapproval of the deed and our sympathy with those who have suffered by it. The cases must be extreme in which such a course is justifiable. There must be no effort made to remove the mote in our brother's eye if we refuse to remove the beam from our own. But in extreme cases, action may be justifiable and proper. What form the action shall take must depend upon the circumstances of the case, that is, upon the degree of the atrocity and upon our power to remedy it. The cases in which we could interfere by force of arms as we interfered to put a stop to intolerable conditions in Cuba are necessarily very few. Yet it is not to be expected that a people like ours, which in spite of certain very obvious shortcomings, nevertheless, as a whole, shows by its consistent practice its belief in the principles of civil and religious liberty and of orderly freedom, a people among whom even the worst crime, like the crime of lynching, is never more than sporadic, so that individuals and not classes are molested in their fundamental rights, it is inevitable that such a nation should desire eagerly to give expression to its horror on occasions like that of the massacre of the Jews in Kishinev, or when it witnesses such systematic and long-extended cruelty and oppression as the cruelty and oppression of which the Armenians have been victims, and which have won for them the indignant pity of the civilized world. Okay, so let me have a look at that in a moment. There's just something I forgot to show you that I would like to show you. Which is this very, very important, the most important thing in the world. Well, maybe not, but pretty important. Go away. Pamantanum. Okay, here it is. This is what I wanted to show you. That up on the blog you will find, and that's the L2, they're the babies, you're the big girls and boys. Two things, yeah. First of all, here you have the MP3 of last week's class on Carnegie. But most important is this thing here. Two things. Some notes on methodology. When the oral comes, you will be asked to comment on an extract from one of the documents. Now, there is not only one way to do a good commentary. I find that the most common student weaknesses are, number one, not talking about the objective of the document. What is the speaker trying to do? Why did they write this? Why did they do this? Number two, not talking about the audience of the document. Who are they talking to? Now, this is slightly easier in this case because this will be, of course, they're talking to the Congress, but this will be summarized in every newspaper the next day. Yeah, so they're really talking to Americans in general. It's very important. It's a big weakness not talking about what happened to the document and or its ideas later in the historical period. So if you're looking at this section, you can certainly do a minute on what happened to the United States afterwards? Well, they got persuaded slowly to join the First World War, and they won it more than anybody else won it, really. They came out as a top nation. Yeah, in 1914, Britain was still the most powerful country in the world. In 1918, America was. Yeah, to simplify. Not talking about how typical the document is or not, you know, what's exceptional about the document. Now, I do realise that you sometimes have too much advice about how to do commentaries and you just like to get sort of frozen on this. But this document, which one of my colleagues produced, seems useful. And if you click there, you get this document, which I highly recommend. It's a little simplified, but it talks about this. I'm not going to look at it now. I just want to make sure you don't forget to go and look at it. Now, if you consider that all this is too simple and too easy for you, that's fine. Don't take any notice. So, there we go. Oh, 17, 15, 16, 22. Oh, dear. 21. I've got confused. Yes, so Roosevelt in this section really is setting out the intentions of the United States. Now, in the very first line there, he says, "It is not true that the United States feels any land hunger or entertains any projects, save those such as those for their welfare." So, it's not true that we want to take over other people's land. Now, this is always a little bit suspicious, you know. If you walk into a shop and the shopkeeper says, "Bonjour, je suis honnête," you immediately, there's something going on here which is not quite right. And so when he starts to say, now he's talking about, he's comparing the United States to the Europeans. The Europeans, only 10 or 12 years earlier, they said, "Okay, here's Africa, this bit's for you, this bit's for you. Do what you can." And so he's trying to distinguish the United States, and he will show, and in fact, it is true in the sense that the United States have not wanted to become old-fashioned colonialists. Partly because they thought they could come out better. Well, first of all, colonialism was getting complicated. Already in India, there's a lot of revolt against the British. And so the idea of the United States of dominating, but not colonizing, it's a modern idea. Yeah, it's a modern idea. Now, of course, he begins by saying the only thing that we're interested in is the welfare of all the people of the Caribbean and of South America. Well, this is what all countries always say, yeah, so we don't really need to, you know, if you ask Vladimir Putin, if you phone him up, he'd say, "What are you doing in Ukraine?" He says, "Well, I'm worried about the welfare of the Ukrainian people." I mean, that's what, you know, that's always, that's fairly par for the course. But he says, we may be forced to act as an international police force. Now, this contrasts somewhat with the reality that they will suddenly discover, because they want to build the Panama Canal, that it's very, very important for Panama to have its independence against those evil Colombians who they had never spoken about before and will never spoke out again. So the practically, of course, he doesn't give specific examples. He remains on the general idea. In general, we're not going to interfere. Of course, sometimes we will be obliged to interfere, but he doesn't justify in detail, in particular. For example, he says nothing about the Philippines. The war with the Philippines, 200,000 people killed, and the Philippines being taken over. He doesn't mention that. I'm sure he does have a justification, but he doesn't do it. He doesn't mention it here. He mentions the situation of Cuba. the American troops have left Cuba, and he mentions the Platt Amendment. Now, the Platt Amendment is quite simply a agreement that the United States has a right to intervene militarily in Cuba. He is representing the idea that the Monroe Doctrine still stands. So he's absolutely not an isolationist. The isolationists will be fighting in 1914 to 1916 successfully for 2 years. They will say America must not join the war in Europe. Isolationist does not mean have no contact. It means don't get involved in exterior. Well, and now this isolationism will come back in the 1920s. But then after the 1930s will be forgotten. I think American isolationism has been forgotten. The Monroe Doctrine, when it was established in 1823, was the side of the end of Spanish rule in Latin America. Now, most of Latin America had its independence for quite a while, quite a lot of it probably in the beginning of the 18th century. Bolivar, has anybody got Bolivar's dates in their minds? I can't never remember dates. In any case, the independence of the Latin America from Spain came all at once. And after that, the Americans with the Monroe Doctrine wanted to warn Spain not to try again to get involved. Okay, so that's the situation we have here. This is the first time he talks about America as the international police force. No previous president mentioned this. This is Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. We are the international police force, and of course, this is still the case today. Yeah, but it still could be considered in Afghanistan, for example, and in Iraq, that the United States should play a role of the international police. Blatterman. Yeah, so it's partly just a justification, a general justification. Our interests and those of our southern neighbours are in reality identical. Again, this is something which is easy to say, but when you are the most powerful by a long way, it's something which it's fair enough, which we should treat with some delicacy. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know. If I come in here with a machine gun and say we have the same interests, you say yes, we have the same interests. But yeah, it doesn't mean everybody is being honest. I won't do this. At least we live in a country where you can joke about this. I mean, in America, you can't joke about it. It's real. It really happens. Horrific. And he gives then a couple of examples of where he believes. That international police force actions should be necessary. At the very end, he mentions the Armenians. Now, the Armenians were tremendously badly treated in Turkey, and a few years later, in 1915, there will be the most well-known event, the genocide, the Armenian genocide, where there will be huge massacres. The Jews in Kishinev. Now, I don't know where Kishinev is. However, massacres of Jews in Eastern Europe were a major phenomenon from 1870 to 1910, regularly here and there. Normally, government-organized pogroms of the population. I don't know the details of what they did with Cuba, Venezuela, and Panama. Oh, well, I explained about Panama. The question of securing the open door to China is tremendously important, because they're understanding that China is going to be a huge capitalist market. Now, China will eventually get rid of the Japanese colonizers in 1927, I think, but it's a long period. In the 1920s, anyway, in the 1920s, and so on. Okay, any particular questions? Something interesting at the end is he said, you know, he says that, you know, the United States is a, you know, we have a right to be the international police because we're a pretty civilized country. And one of the things he says is he talks about lynching. Now, lynching is the, you know, this is the time of the Ku Klux Klan. Yeah, it's the assassination of black men, mostly men, to make sure that the entire black population accepts its position. And it's a rather surprising argument he gives, because he says lynching is terrible, but you know, they only kill individuals and not like the Jews, whole collective massacres. I mean, you know, it's a little indecent, really. I think you're supposed to say, oh well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Roosevelt. Hey, Mr. Roosevelt. There is in line 41, it says, of course, he says we can be the international police, but we must be careful. And he says we must not be obsessed with the mote in our brother's eye when there is a beam in our own. Now, a mote is an extremely small piece of wood, and a beam is a huge piece of wood. This I'm pretty sure that this is from the Bible, so I'm just checking. Ah, there you go. I got it right. Yeah, this is Jesus. And in the old, you know, Jesus, that guy, yeah, okay, right, you remember him, yeah, you know, right, Easter eggs rising again, cool, Holy Sepulchre, yeah, that's actually where I went for my, in the holidays in February, I went to Jerusalem and saw the Holy Sepulchre. The funny thing is that there are two Jesus tombs in Jerusalem because people don't agree about where it was, so there's actually two places you could go to see Jesus' tomb. Isn't that cool? So this is Matthew, so the New Testament, the Gospel, the story of Jesus' life by Matthew. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in the brother eye and considerest not the beam that is in their own eye? The idea is you're criticizing your brother for a little thing when you have a much bigger sin or imperfection. So that's the meaning of it. Now, obviously, if you were commenting this bit and you didn't know the meaning of it, don't mention it. But if you know it, make sure you mention it because you're trying to impress people. Yeah. This is rhetorical, really. You know, he's saying, "Yo, you know, we need to be the international police force, but of course we must be careful to look at the terrible things we sometimes do at home as well." Yes, it's a little bit kind of a sort of moral preaching of a particular kind. Okay. Any more questions about this particular bit? Now, I haven't really been looking at the different chronologies which are in your book. But if we go back to page 58, the first page of your second volume booklet here, page 58, you can see that you have this chronology here, the United States 1854 to 1906. And this is very useful to make sure that you get things in perspective. So you can see in the 1850s the insurrection against slavery and Abraham Lincoln. Then the Civil War and the proclamation of emancipation. The foundation of the Ku Klux Klan just after the Civil War, and 1869, the 14th Amendment, where black people getting the vote in theory, although as we know, especially in the South, people will work very hard to make sure this doesn't really happen. 1880, then the first segregation laws in the South. The war with some Indian tribes continuing, 1876, Little Bighorn. And if we go over the page, the founding of the huge trade union, the American Federation of Labor, in 1886. The founding of the National American Women's Suffrage Organization in 1890. And on the right-hand side, you have some of the cultural, events, which might be interesting. Okay, well, listen, that's all I have to say today. So I'm going to stop there, unless you have a particular question. And I will see you next week. And this week I will be studying Nelson Mandela. That's a little bit easier because I knew something about him already, whereas Roosevelt, I knew something about the guy.